Welcome back to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service for August 2009. In place of Market Scope on this edition, we have a special tribute to newsman Walter Cronkite, who recently passed away. Bill Pasternak from Amateur Radio Newsline put together this perspective of Uncle Walter.
On Friday, July 17th, a legend in broadcast journalism and in ham radio passed from the scene. That person was the man who eventually became known as the most trusted person in America. Of course, we're talking about Walter Cronkite, KB2 GSD. With a look at the man, his career, and his connection to amateur radio, here's Mark Abramovich, NT3V.
Ham radio became a late-in-life hobby to KB2 GSD, and he didn't get into it for the reasons that most of us did. In Walter Cronkite's case, he was in love with sailing and owned his own boat. It was suggested by some of his co-workers at CBS News, who were hams, that having an amateur radio station on board would be an additional measure of safety. One of those CBS hams was former ARRL director Steve Mendelson, W2ML, now with ABC.
Well, in the first 20 years of my career in broadcasting, I was fortunate enough to be an engineer for the CBS radio network. In that capacity, many of the big names of 60 Minutes, our CBS Evening News, and many of the names that became household icons passed through the little control room that I operated in, one of which was Walter Cronkite. And Walter was always interested in ham radio, but said he could never pass the code test. And for years, Walter and I shared a love of the sea. I actually retired after 30 years in the Navy and Navy Reserve as a Navy senior chief. So Walter and I would spend 15 to 20 minutes each day just talking about ham radio, talking about the Navy and his sailing.
Also working at CBS at the time as a news producer was current CQ editor Rich Moseson, W2VU. He was N2BFG back then, and an associate producer of the award-winning children's series In the News. He, along with Mendelson, were the two volunteer examiners who administered Walter Cronkite's novice class Morse test.
I remember my boss at the time, Joel Heller, WA2FFI, who was an executive producer at CBS News, calling me into his office one day, and Steve Mendelson and Walter Cronkite were sitting there, and he said, Mr. Cronkite's decided to get his ham license and wants to take his test, and Steve's going to do the written test, and this is for the novice, and would you be willing to give him the code test? So, of course, I said yes.
And what an exam it was. Back in those days, the novice came by mail and required only two higher-grade hams to administer the test. Moseson and Steve Mendelson gave Walter his novice Morse test in a most unusual setting. Again, Steve Mendelson, W2ML.
When the talent came in and sat down in front of the microphone, you always took your tone oscillator and set a proper level into the recording devices, in this case some very, very old tape recorders. And while I had the tone up, I looked at the producer, and the producer this particular day was Rich Moseson, now W2VU, and I started sending code just for fun. Walter sat behind the microphone, took his pencil out, and started copying. I did that for 10 minutes, picked up a copy of the New York Times, and just sent a sentence out of the Times. I think it was about, actually, three long sentences. And Richard timed it. And when we were done, I said to Walter, how did you do? And he read them back perfectly. So Rich and I looked at each other and said, yep, okay, he just passed the code test. And I hit the intercom between the control room and the recording booth, and I said, are you sure you couldn't pass a code test? And he said, no, I'd be too nervous. And I just smiled at Rich. Rich smiled at me. And I said, well, you just passed your code test. Now you better go study for the written.
And that was it. The FCC assigned Walter Cronkite the call letters KB2GSD. That call and his novice license were the only ones he ever held. And while he was not on the air very much, Steve Mendelson remembers one very amusing 10-meter QSO that he and Cronkite were both part of.
Walter had gotten on 10 meters without very much in the way of activity. It was a sunspot minimum that year. And so he called me on the phone and said, would you at least work me so I can say I've talked to somebody? Well, little did he know, it was one of those crazy days when 10 meters was open to the Midwest, but he could barely hear me. So we're talking to each other, and suddenly a gentleman comes in from Kansas City and says, that is the worst Walter Cronkite imitation I have ever heard. And I did the usual QRZ. He came back to me with his call sign, and he said, your friend does a lousy Cronkite imitation. So I turned it over to Walter, KB2GSD, this is WA2DHF. Could you do that imitation again? And he said, hi, my name is Walter, Whiskey America Lima Tango Echo Romeo, and I'm in New York City. And there's dead silence for a minute. The guy comes on and says, okay, you have the same first name, but come on, Walter Cronkite on ham radio? Never gonna happen. And I said to the gentleman, well, actually, that is Walter Cronkite. And he said, you know, you guys from New York, all you want to do is fool people or take us in the Midwest for fools. Well, we're not. And with that, he signed off. And Walter said, are they all like that?
Walter Cronkite's ham radio legacy was assured in 2002 when he agreed to narrate the ARRL-sponsored video Amateur Radio Today. Dave Bell, W6AQ, was the executive producer of that project and tells us how Cronkite's involvement came about.
Bill Pasternak and Alan Call and I, all, and Jim Haney, the president of the ARRL, we all wanted Walter Cronkite to narrate this film. And we got Bill Baker, who was the head of public television in New York City and happens to be W1BKR, to ask Walter if he'd do it, and Walter said he would. So I went to New York with my little digital video camera, and when Walter saw me in his office, I got there before he did, with a little camera, he knew that he wasn't just going to narrate this film, that he was actually going to host it. So we chatted about how much more effective it would be if he were on camera, and he agreed with me. And so he narrated the thing perfectly. We did three or four sentences at a time, and then we would pause, and then he'd go right on. And my friend Alan wrote that script, and Walter only changed one word. And it's probably the ham radio film that I am the most proud of. And it really does cement Walter's connection to amateur radio.
2 years later, as broadband over powerline internet access threatened to wipe out much of the high-frequency ham radio spectrum, the ARRL again turned to Dave Bell for a video to help educate the ham radio public on this threat to its survival. The script by the late Alan Call, W6RCL, was written with Walter Cronkite in mind to narrate. The question was, would he? Once again, Dave Bell, W6AQ.
The ARRL was having no luck at all with the FCC, and they wanted the members of Congress and all of the FCC commissioners who were reasonable to understand the ARRL's position about broadband over power line, which basically just wiped out the high-frequency spectrum for hams, any place that BPL was employed. So, once again, getting Walter to host a film about BPL gave it weight that no other person in the entire country could give it. When a congressman or an executive in Washington of any kind gets a DVD and it says, narrated by Walter Cronkite, that means it's true. And I don't think that film would have been nearly as effective with anybody else narrating it.
Walter Leland Cronkite Jr. was born in St. Joseph, Missouri on November 4, 1916. Having developed an interest in the media in 1935, he dropped out of college in his junior year after starting a series of newspaper reporting jobs covering news and sports. Cronkite's first broadcast job came the same year when he landed an announcer's job at WKY Radio in Oklahoma City. In 1936, he met his future wife, Betsy Maxwell, while working as the sports announcer for KCMO in Kansas City. In 1950, Walter Cronkite began his television career, working at Washington, D.C. station WTOB-TV after being recruited into CBS News by the great Edward R. Murrow. On July 7, 1952, the term anchor was coined to describe Cronkite's role at the first ever telecast of the Democratic and Republican national conventions. In the 1950s, Walter Cronkite hosted the CBS programs You Are There and The 20th Century. Later, he also hosted a game show called It's News to Me, based on news events. On April 16, 1962, Cronkite succeeded Douglas Edwards as the anchor for the prestigious CBS Evening News. Under Cronkite's 19 years at its helm, the CBS Evening News acquired a reputation for accuracy and depth in its broadcast journalism, and Cronkite himself was given the title of the most trusted man in America. This because of his professionalism and kindly demeanor when reporting. By the time Walter Cronkite retired from the Evening News on March 6, 1981, he had become affectionately dubbed Uncle Walter by his millions of nightly viewers, the same people who had earlier named him the most trusted man in America. After turning the reins of the CBS Nightly News over to Dan Rather, he went on to another career as one of the world's greatest commentators, guest speakers, and documentarians. This included hosting the annual Vienna New Year's concert on PBS and the Kennedy Center Honors Performance from Washington. In addition to appearing in the two ARRL ham radio videos, most recently he teamed up with his son Chip, producing material that aired on the new retirement TV network. Across all of his years in broadcasting and broadcast journalism, Walter Cronkite won many literary awards. And on March 1, 2006, KB2-GSD became the first non-astronaut to receive NASA's Ambassador of Exploration Award, this in recognition of his support and reporting on the United States space program. On June 26, Cronkite's family issued a short statement that read, and we quote, "In order to dispel false rumors, Walter Cronkite's family want it known that, sadly, he is very ill and is not expected to recuperate. He is resting at home, surrounded by family, friends, and a wonderful medical team. We thank everyone for their prayers and good wishes." End quote. Now, Walter Cronkite, KB2-GSD, may no longer be among us, but the legacy he left behind will be a part of the world and the world of amateur radio forever. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Mark Abramovich, NT3V, reporting.
And that report was courtesy of Amateur Radio Newsline, and we'd like to thank Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, for allowing us to use that feature. Now it's time for our musings to the members. Just a reminder that if you'd like to use the musings in the interim, our telephone number that we're using is area code 646-402-5685, and the password for the musings is 62544. Now here's a few musings.
Hello, fellow DXers. Wayne Ryan in Brantford, Ontario. CBE 1550 in Windsor, Ontario, is going FM. I'm a little bit surprised about this. They're one of the last AM CBC stations still going, but they've got out very well with 10,000 watts. I've had them as far away as Nashville when I lived down there. And my friend Dave Wattmau down here in Hamilton has had them in Barbados and said it was the clearest Canadian station he could get down there. I've had some music come up on 950, maybe about three or four nights, and also 1370. The 950 one may have been from Maryland, I understand. Well, a couple of great catches, I think. First of all, this is really something in my books. On 1000, about 5 o'clock last Saturday morning, between 5 and 6, I was getting Radio 1000 from Cleveland. They're only 500 watts. And on 980, I picked up TKNW in Vancouver. It used to be in New Westminster, B.C., British Columbia, and that's thousands of miles away. I'm in eastern Canada, and that's way out west, close to the Washington border.
Hello, Audio Service members. Mike Buchan calling from Hayward, Wisconsin. Last month, I did one of the best things that I could ever do, and that was to renew my subscription to the DX Audio Service for another year, and I'm sure glad I did. Also, during the month of June, my wife and I went out and spent 2 weeks off in Charlotte, North Carolina, to visit our daughter and little granddaughter. And, of course, my radio went along with me, and I got a couple of things I can report about. There have been a couple of stations that have been silent. First of all, 7:30 in Shelby, North Carolina. I think the call is WMLS. They were part of a three-station hookup called The Boss, which played a combination of oldies and beach music, Carolina beach music. They're silent now. 11:50 in Rock Hill, South Carolina, which was a part of a three-station network called the Christian Connection, is now running the Music of Your Life format under the call WAVO. They call themselves WAVO 1150, and they also broadcast this, the format in parallel on 1410 WEGO in Kannapolis, North Carolina. 1220, there was a station last year from Kings Mountain, North Carolina, which came in pretty loud where we were staying, and they were bringing talk programming like the Bill O'Reilly Factor and programs with Dr. Laura and programs like that. Well, that station's now gone. 1450, which is in Gastonia, North Carolina, which was part of that three-station hookup called The Boss, they're called WGNC. They've now picked up the talk programming that 1220 was carrying. They bring that Christian financial consultant Dave Ramsey. They also bring Dr. Laura and a bunch of auto racing stuff on the weekends. Also, they also carry the Atlanta Braves baseball games. And also there's been some additional stations in Spanish on the FM dial out there. I also have a question. I read on the internet that CKWW 580 from Windsor, Ontario, has now switched to an oldies format. I'm just wondering if Fred or Phil or somebody down there that can hear them, I wonder what they sound like these days.
And that is our musings to the members on this edition of the DX Audio Service. And remember our new telephone number there, at least for the time being, until we get our phone lines situated around. And give us a call if you have something important to say. Remember, keep it brief and to the point so everyone has a chance to speak. If you remember about a year ago, I mentioned that I was taking a lot of my content, my old records and tapes, jingles, air checks, and all that kind of stuff, and putting them onto CDs. Well, imagine my surprise here when I read this article, which was in the Toledo Blade newspaper, written by Kirk Baird, who is a Toledo Blade staff writer. He writes, "Disappearing Act. Is demise of CDs and DVDs a good thing? Alas, poor CDs and DVDs. We hardly knew ye. After an all-too-brief relationship, your shiny silver coaster-sized discs are being replaced by an invisible stream of numbers hidden away on some faceless hard drive. Tangible is giving away to convenience. And yes, there is something to be said about that. It's great to have access to most of your music collection while on a 6-hour cross-country flight, and the ability to stream thousands of movies and TV shows through your content provider like Netflix and Amazon.com without leaving the comfort of your living room or office is the bee's knees, so to speak. But does the evolution of the digital revolution as we embrace MP3 and MP4 files really mean the end of physical media? The sales numbers, particularly for CDs, would strongly indicate yes. In 2008, CD sales dropped almost 25% from the previous year, while album downloads were up nearly 34% from 2007, according to the Recording Industry Association of America. Meanwhile, according to an article in Variety, sales of DVDs continues to decline, down 9% from 2008, from the year before. However, sales of Blu-ray discs, the superior successor to DVDs, grew to $750 million last year, or three times what it was in 2007. But missing in all the decreasing sales percentages and dire pronouncements of physical media are the advantages to owning a physical copy of your favorite album or movie. Like the ego-stroking self-satisfaction of showing off your CD and or DVD library to others. Collecting the discs is akin to the theory that the more books you own, the better read you are. But try that with 2 terabyte hard drives filled with MP3s and MP4s and gauge the reaction of friends, family members, and neighbors. It's just not the same. Hard drives packed with media files will never be as impressive, visually speaking, as owning the entire CD catalogs of Miles Davis and Bob Dylan or the DVD box sets of the uber-massive and uber-expensive United Artists 90th Anniversary Prestige Collection. And what about the extras that come with CDs and DVDs? Marcia Etzweiler, a 58-year-old Fremont resident, is a music fanatic who is always on the hunt for undiscovered artists. She doesn't own a computer or an iPod, nor does she intend to. And she misses the days of spending hours in her record store browsing through the selections to find a colorful album cover that caught her eye. Most of the time, her purchases proved wise. Then she moved on to CDs. It wasn't exactly love at first sight, she said. What I didn't like about CDs when they first came out was the liner notes. They didn't have any, she said. As record labels beefed up the bare-bones CD packaging by including song lyrics, artist photos, and liner notes, Etzweiler embraced the little discs. Now she owns close to 2,000 of them. And while her beloved format is far from extinct, she's already lamenting its demise. Most of the local music stores are long gone. Borders, she said, eliminated much of its CD collection, including the store's classical and blues selections. Even Walmart doesn't stock nearly as many CDs as it used to, as the retail giant moves further into the MP3 era with its own music download store. Within a decade, Etzweiler said, there will be no more CDs. Perhaps. But dwindling sales figures be damned, there's a lot to love about owning a real copy of an album or movie, one that you can hold in your hands, including, as Etzweiler said, the packaging that comes along with the CD or DVD, especially the box set typically bought by fans and collectors. Plus, depending on your internet connection speed, a trip to the store to buy a DVD will probably be faster than downloading it, especially for a 20-gigabyte Blu-ray. Owning the physical media of an album or movie, as opposed to an electronic file, is also a better long-term investment. If a disc is treated with reasonable care, you can expect it to last quite a while. Anywhere from 25 to 100 years, barring an act of God such as the usual flood, fire, or earthquake, in which case the loss of a music collection doesn't quite seem so important compared to the loss of a home. But if a hard drive crashes with 3,000 songs and 20 movies on it, unless you made a backup, and seriously, how many of you have done that, the files are gone for good. Vanish because of an unknown error or mechanical mishap. Not to mention, there's always the chance of an accidental deletion of a folder containing the files. Guilty as charged. Yes, CDs and DVDs can be ruined by the elements. Have you ever seen a CD that's been baked in the sun? Not pretty, but so can an MP3 player or laptop. And those are a lot more expensive to replace than a CD or DVD. Still, technology marches relentlessly forward. It never slows down or looks back. And already, a generation has grown up with little knowledge of record albums and even cassette tapes. And already, a generation has no idea what they're missing. This story came from Kirk Baird. His email address is kbaird@theblade.com. He is a Toledo Blade staff writer. What is ironic about Kirk's story is that I've been doing a lot of transfers of tape, cassette, albums, and such to MP3 format or WAV format, and then putting them on CDs and DVDs with secondary backups on hard drives, which I purchase the hard drive, put all the content on it, and then I just take it out of the machine, seal it up, and put it on the shelf. And hopefully, either the CD, DVD, in some cases, thumb drives and hard drives, one of them is going to survive for a long time. Hopefully. Otherwise, I've lost a lot of content. But do you realize that albums, 78s, 45s, and such, tend to last a long, long time? You wonder about our technology. Another area of technology we have to wonder about is shortwave broadcasting. Talking with Bill Pasternak of Amateur Radio Newsline, and he made an interesting statement that a lot of the international shortwave broadcasters, such as Radio Netherlands, are now depending upon audiences that are on the internet versus over the radio. Kind of interesting, because I'm one of those old buzzards that still listen to shortwave broadcasts from time to time. And in fact, in my car, I've got a Yaesu FT-857D ham radio, and a lot of times I'll just tune that over to the international shortwave bands and listen to newscasts and shows on shortwave rather than listening to the domestic AM and FM stations, which, excuse me for the opinion, tend to have nothing of interest. So imagine my surprise when another article popped up, which I thought was very interesting, titled America's Shortwave Panorama, CBS On the Air Shortwave from Philadelphia. I bet you didn't know about this. Here's the story. During the radio era, before World War II, there was quite a movement here in the United States and in other countries throughout the world also to establish shortwave relay stations in an endeavor to give wider broadcast coverage. At the time, television was a concept and not a reality, and FM radio was still a distant dream. The medium wave band was not overcrowded, though the medium wave signal generally gave only to local coverage. However, shortwave transmissions could give wide area coverage within the country and even international coverage on a much wider scale. Many medium wave stations in the United States established shortwave relay transmitters during the late 1920s and throughout the 1930s to carry their programming to distant listeners. In fact, it's estimated that there have been somewhat around 100 shortwave stations on the air in the United States during the past 80 years, and probably more than half of these were actually during the pre-war era, that is World War II. One of the shortwave stations that held a high reputation back in the early years was located in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. This station was launched on behalf of the co-located medium wave station, WCAU, under the call sign W3XAU. And again, even though a casual glance would seem to indicate that this was an amateur radio station, this was not the case. Station W3XAU was indeed a professional station, relaying the programming from medium wave station WCAU 1210. The X in a pre-war call sign indicated an experimental station, either amateur or professional, and in this case, indeed professional.
The medium wave station WCAU was launched in 1922 as a very small operation located in the back room of a small radio shop in Philadelphia. 10 years later, following a couple of intermediate migrations, WCAU was installed in a professionally built studio complex, the first building in the United States that was constructed specifically for a radio station. This facility was located at 1622 Chestnut Street in Philadelphia. Now, at the time, a new 50-kilowatt medium-wave transmitter was under construction. Also, and this was installed in the new building out at Newton Square. The initial broadcast from this grand new WCAU was on September 19th, 1932. Before we leave the medium wave scans to take a look at the shortwave events in Philadelphia, just a touch of humor from the TV series Gilligan's Island. On July 5th, 1992, Gilligan and his six fellow castaways on a lone and unidentified tropical island somewhere out in the Pacific tuned their radio receiver, and they heard a broadcast from a radio station that gave the identification announcement, WCAU. At the time, the real WCAU Philadelphia had become WOGL, and so there was really no radio station on the air with the call sign WCAU at that stage. Not only was there a new suite of studios and offices and a new transmitter facility back in 1932, but the relatively new medium of shortwave broadcasting was also under development. Early in the year of 1930, a small locally made 1-kilowatt shortwave transmitter with call sign W3XAU was installed with the regular medium wave unit in Philadelphia. It is claimed that this is the first license issued by the Federal Communications Commission for an international shortwave broadcast station as a commercial operation. However, 2 years after the Newton Square facility was inaugurated, a rebuilt version of the same 1-kilowatt shortwave transmitter was installed alongside the huge 50-kilowatt medium-wave unit. All of these developments took place during the era when the innovative William Paley of late CBS fame was at the helm. 4 years later, this same transmitter was rebuilt to 10-kilowatt capacity, and two V-type antennas were erected for coverage into Europe and South America. Station WCAU became even more ambitious for a truly international outreach with the erection of two large curtain antennas for coverage into the same areas, Europe and South America. At the same time, they made a request to the Federal Licensing Authority for 50-kilowatt operation on shortwave. In fact, on several occasions in the late 1930s and early 1940s, they made similar applications, but on each occasion, that request was denied. With war clouds developing over Europe in 1939, the Federal Communications Commission took a hard look at the international shortwave scene in the United States and issued three new rules. This edict, issued on May 23rd of 1939, required that shortwave call signs should be regularized, power should be increased to 50 kilowatts, and directional antennas should be installed. As far as call signs were concerned, this edict gave time for consideration and negotiation regarding desired call signs. Initially, the first new call sign chosen to replace W3XAU was WCAI. This new call sign for the shortwave outlet WCAI proved to be only temporary. With information derived from Time Magazine, FCC news releases, and several other sources, it was learned that this temporary new call sign was in use for as little as 2 weeks, beginning in mid-August of 1939. The Federal Communications Commission subsequently ruled that all call sign changes for the shortwave stations should become effective on September 1st. However, some stations introduced their new call signs prematurely, and at least a couple were a little tardy with implementing the change. As far as W3XAU is concerned, the change from the initial WCAI to the subsequent WCAB was implemented on August 26, 1 week before the official date. As far as the directional antennas, they were already in place. And the power increase to 50 kW? Well, they already applied on several occasions and had been denied. However, there was another mitigating factor involved. CBS had a large new shortwave station under construction at Brentwood on Long Island. Initially, the concept was for WCAB in Philadelphia to supplement the new Brentwood facility. However, in view of the power restriction, it was finally considered best to close the Pennsylvania station in favor of the large new facility under development on Long Island. Programming from the Philadelphia shortwave station was initially a tandem relay of medium wave station WCAU, though separate identification announcements were given live over the air. However, when the station became a genuine international broadcaster, much of the scheduling was specifically prepared programming for the target areas, Europe and Latin America. Programming in foreign languages was taken on relay from the CBS sister shortwave station, W2XE, in Wayne, New Jersey, and programming in English was also taken live from the CBS National Network. This shortwave station was heard quite frequently throughout the Americas, over Europe, and also in the South Pacific. The new 50-kilowatt shortwave transmitter, WCRC, in Brentwood, was officially inaugurated on January 1st of 1941. Just 1 year later, the 10-kilowatt W3XAU, WCAI, and WCAB at Newton Square was finally switched off. And this nostalgic event occurred at midnight, December 31st, in the same year, 1941. However, that's not the end of the story. The large new international shortwave station at Brentwood was taken into service with OWI and VOA, the Office of War Information and the Voice of America, programming less than 2 months later on February 24th of 1942, and the 10-kilowatt unit in Philadelphia was packed up and sent over to England for use by the BBC in London. How interesting it would have been to find out information from the other side of the Atlantic as to what happened to this famous America transmitter while it was in service over there in Europe. And this article was by Dr. Adrian M. Peterson, who writes about shortwave and radio events.
Since April of 1985, this is the DX Audio Service, a nonprofit organization devoted to the radio listening hobby.
And it's time right now for a receiver review. It seems that Gary DeBrock has purchased himself a brand new toy, and he writes, "Hello all, very impressed with the performance of the new Texan PL300WT DSP Enhanced Ultralight Radio on medium wave, so it was a natural decision to place an order on Amazon.com for the new full-size Texan CR1100 AM-FM portable, which uses the same innovative SI43031 DSP chip from Silicon Labs. Today, my new CR1100 portable arrived from Kato Electronics after a 4-day delay and a payment of $69.99 plus $13 shipping by USPS Priority Mail. The CR1100 is strictly a Chinese market portable to the extent that all the controls are labeled only in Chinese. Despite this, Kato has provided a very basic, but poorly translated English manual, as well as the standard and far more thorough Chinese manual. The AM frequency steps have also been reprogrammed to 10 kHz, matching the North American market. Immediately after arrival, the radio's out-of-box AM performance was tested against a fully aligned Sony ICF S5W portable, which has had the frequency coverage extended to 1700. The comparison of these two radios proved to be very interesting and showed that while the CR1100 has some good DXing potential on AM, it also has some puzzling shortcomings. In comparison to the PL300WT's sharp DSP enhanced selectivity, the CR1100 had some tough time going up against the ICF S5W with its common 455 kHz Murata filter. Local slop on the CR1100 was more troublesome than that of the PL300WT, making it seem like Texan programmed the DSP chip to provide a wider selectivity setting on this music-oriented receiver. The ICF S5W is able to weekly receive KPO 560 in the null of semi-local KVI 570 in the early afternoon, while the CR1100 could only produce KVI splatter. Low-band sensitivity on the CR1100 was very good, but not quite up to the class-leading ICF S5W standard. Although the CR1100's low-band sensitivity will match that of the PL300WT, unlike the 300WT, the CR1100 cannot tune in 1 kHz steps, making it impossible to chase TPs on the 9 kHz splits. The CR1100 versus the ICF S5W contest became more competitive on the high band because, and on the high X band, the new Texan was clearly far more sensitive than the classic Sony portable. In fact, the CR1100 sets a new standard for X band sensitivity among the portables, having weak signal performance never experienced in extensive testing here. Weak fringe stations that were barely audible on the ICF S5W had solid audio on the Texan. Also noted in the CR1100 was the complete freedom from image reception of local stations, a major shortcoming of the classic ICF S5W. The Sony's image reception detracts greatly from its otherwise stellar performance, but the Texan's DSP chip appears to have solved the problem entirely. After an out-of-box performance test, the CR1100 was disassembled to check the loopstick construction and the possibility of alignment. Both the PL300WT and the CR1100 were designed to have no alignment RF system, in which the DSP chip ensures maximum performance without loopstick peaking or adjustments of a 1400 kHz trimmer. In the CR1100, there is a 4.25 by 0.36 single coil loopstick in the middle of the cabinet, which seems rather odd because of the extensive cabinet space on both sides, which would allow placement of a much longer ferrite bar if desired. Alignment was attempted by shifting the coil, but this had no effect on the CR1100 sensitivity on any frequency. Apparently, DXers will need to accept the CR1100 sensitivity as delivered unless they wish to transplant a larger ferrite bar of a coil of equal inductance, which is certainly possible with the extra cabinet space. The CR1100 also has a sensitive FM selection, although again, for some unknown reason, it seems that slightly less sensitivity of that of the PL300WT. Perhaps there is a greater impedance mismatch on the CR1100's short whip antenna, but in any case, the PL300WT's ultralight can receive more weak fringe FM stations than the CR1100. The CR1100 has a large music-oriented speaker and excellent audio with analog tone and volume control knobs. The 8-ohm speaker has a 1-watt rated output. The radio also has 300 memories and various digital tuning capabilities. It operates on 4 D-cell batteries and comes in an attractive brown-black cabinet. It is available from Amazon.com via Kato Electronics for $69.99 plus $13 shipping. One last time. That's right. This is the last time I'm going to be able to remind you that the National Radio Club and WTFDA convention will be coming up over Friday, September the 4th through the 6th. This year's convention is going to be held in the Lehigh Valley of Pennsylvania, a little town called Allentown, which was named after Billy Joel recorded this song. No, just kidding. With members of the WTFDA joining the National Radio Club members, besides the regular events such as the auction, the banquet, the quiz, the AAA Lehigh Valley Iron Pigs minor league baseball team will be in town, and this will be their last home stand of the season. The convention is going to be held at the Roadway Inn at 1151 Bulldog Drive in Allentown, Pennsylvania, 18104. This hotel is conveniently located near Routes 22 and 309 and the northeast extension of the Pennsylvania Turnpike. It is also close to the Lehigh Valley International Airport. Now, to reserve your room, call the Roadway Inn direct at 1-888-395-5200. Make sure that you mention that you're with the National Radio Club to get the $69 room rate. That's before taxes, and you can have up to 4 people staying in the room for that rate. You can get either a 1-king bed or 2 double beds. The website for the motel is www.roadwayinallentown.com. That's roadwayinallentown.com. This motel was formerly known as the Days Inn Convention Center. Convention registration is $45. Make your checks payable to the National Radio Club, and you mail those to Bob Smolarek at 51 Mark Drive, Highbridge, New Jersey, 18829. Also, send any auction items you might have to Bob. More details will be furnished on the tower hunting, the tours, and guest speaker when you arrive on Friday, September the 4th. By the way, I won't be able to attend this year's convention because of my project at the television station, so perhaps somebody can help out Mr. Paul Swearingen with the auction and do some of the usual antics that I pull off at the convention. If you would, I'd appreciate anyone recording the convention, and perhaps we can feature some highlights on a upcoming edition. That's it for the August edition. We'll see you in 30 days. 73 Good DX, and get out and support radio.